From WHYY in cool and gray Philadelphia, I'm Sedge Thompson, and this is Fresh Air. I'm here this week while Terry Gross is on vacation. On this edition of Fresh Air, we scope out the future of technology with Nobel laureate Arno Penzias. Penzias heads the researchers at the Bell Labs, encouraging and cheering them on to innovate. Donald Norman, meanwhile, looks at why our lives aren't easier, despite or because of designers. Norman looks at the inefficient and clumsy designs of VCRs, computers, and airplane cockpits, and suggests ways to rethink the designs of our everyday tools. Rock historian Ed Ward profiles singer Larry Williams, and Maureen Corrigan has some thoughts on Salman Rushdie and his recent reply to his persecutors. That's all coming up on today's Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Dale Willman. The White House today dismissed the latest comments by Iraqi President Saddam Hussein as more of the same rhetoric Americans have already heard. NPR's Richard Gonzalez reports from Kennebunkport, Maine.
Earlier in the day, a spokesman for Saddam Hussein said his government is willing to negotiate an end to the Persian Gulf crisis. The spokesman also said if the United States persists in its threats, then Iraq will emerge the victor. White House spokesman Marlon Fitzwater said all nations that are involved in the multinational force to deter Iraq are willing to talk, but only within the context of Iraq's compliance with the UN resolutions calling for that country's withdrawal from Kuwait. Otherwise, Fitzwater said, there is no need to respond to Saddam Hussein's rhetoric.
The world is united in demanding that Iraq withdraw from Kuwait, and that has not changed one iota by these comments this morning.
Fitzwater also said the president will be briefed on the military situation by Defense Secretary Richard Cheney tomorrow. I'm Richard Gonzalez with the president in Kennebunkport, Maine.
A group of Western European nations agreed today to coordinate activities aimed at enforcing UN economic sanctions against Iraq. Meanwhile, British Prime Minister Margaret Thatcher broke a two-week-long silence and condemned Iraq's treatment of Westerners. NPR's Brian Naylor reports from London.
The Western European Union, a little-known nine-nation military alliance, is forming a joint command to coordinate the military efforts of its members in the Gulf. Six of the WEU's nine nations have or are sending ships to the Gulf. The largest military contingent is from Great Britain, which also has the most citizens caught in Kuwait in Iraq. Today, Prime Minister Thatcher lashed out at Saddam Hussein's threats against those Britons.
Saddam Hussein is now trying, in his tactics, to hide behind Western women and children and use them as human shields and use them as part of his negotiations. We do not enter into such negotiations. These people are entitled to certain fundamental human rights.
At least 120 Britons are being held against their will in Kuwait. Mrs. Thatcher today agreed with President Bush that they should be called hostages. This is Brian Naylor in London.
Japan, which gets 70% of its oil imports from the Middle East, said today it will help Jordan financially if it applies United Nations sanctions against Iraq. Tokyo made the pledge during a meeting between officials of the two countries. Jordan, a major handler of trade to and from Iraq, faces severe economic hardship if it honors the sanctions. Closing off the border to Iraqi and Kuwaiti goods would also deprive Jordan of about 95% of its crude oil supplies. Iraq said today it's completed its military withdrawal from Iranian territory under a peace initiative announced 6 days ago by President Saddam Hussein. The final pullout was announced in a statement broadcast over Iraqi radio. On Wall Street, stock prices closed sharply lower today. The Dow Jones Industrial Average fell over 52 points to 2603.96. This is NPR.
This is Fresh Air. Terry Gross is on her vacation. I'm Sedge Thompson. In 1964, seeking to develop an antenna to measure various forms of radiation clearly and precisely, physicists Robert Wilson and Arno Penzias kept getting some interference, like poor reception in your stereo system, a hiss, a hum. The scientists at first feared the noise would interfere with their experiment, but in fact, the hiss was generated by photons left over from the moment the universe began, 12 to 16 billion years ago. The sounds they heard were radio fossils from the Big Bang. This discovery of what is now known as cosmic blackbody radiation helped confirm the Big Bang theory, and Wilson and Penzias received the Nobel Prize in Physics in 1978 for their work. Arno Penzias is my guest today. He's currently Vice President of Research at the AT&T Bell Labs in New Jersey, where he helps guide other scientists in the creation and effective use of information technology in our society. His new book, Ideas and Information, Managing in a High-Tech World, covers the evolution of computers, the mathematical operations underlying numerical processing, and the major differences between human and machine intelligence. In a New York Times book review, Timothy Bay wrote that Penzias has the shirt sleeves practicality of the manager combined with the scientist insider's familiarity with technology. I asked Arno Penzias how he encourages people at Bell Labs to innovate.
Well, I hope your listeners will take an honest answer. I work very hard on small rewards for good behavior. I can't tell people in advance how to innovate. All I can do is tell them when I like something, when I respond positively. And words are cheap, so I try little tokens. I give out books, T-shirts, chocolate bars, nice 400-gram, and in fact, sometimes I even give out the 5-kilogram chocolate bars in case it's a team effort. And I think that that the notion of rewarding good behavior is probably the best way of leading any human enterprise.
I mean, it makes you sound like, in many ways, kind of like Rodney Dangerfield in Back to School, you know, passing out the pens in the classroom to his colleagues. You know, sort of a salesman impressing the clients.
Well, you know, it's kind of funny. I mean, human institutions have, after all, are all organized around human beings, and I don't think scientists are all that different. You do try to avoid censorship. You do try to act as a role model, I know I do, by not worrying terribly much about making mistakes and about being willing to stick my neck out, make an estimate, come up with something which might be wrong and try to fix it later. I don't wait until I have every possible fact at my fingertips before I venture an opinion. I do label it as an opinion. I do label it as a tentative first thrust. But I think that that's another way of innovating, which is to just start out, do something, try it, and see how it works.
It sounds like you encourage the idea of failure in the research and development labs.
Absolutely. I think if we don't have failure, if we're doing everything, if we only do things which are guaranteed to succeed, we're not doing our job. Just by definition, if we're going out and looking at the unknown, some fraction of those things have to fail. Otherwise, the amount of new knowledge you can gather is pretty small. You know, one of the troubles with history books, especially the history of science, is it's almost always written in the way that the scientist would have liked to behave rather than the way it really went. All the kinds of mistakes people make, people feel guilty about, and then try to hide them later from themselves and from others. And so what ultimately comes out is the is a clear line of the steps of going from A to B to C to D, and all the little detours, almost all of them, are left out. I think that's what I liked about the Double Helix, a book written by Jim Watson some years ago, where some of the blunders and side issues came out in his day-to-day story of how he worked on the first modeling of DNA. Human research and all in human inquiry is an iterative process, and it's fraught with dead ends. The trouble is that most of us feel a little ashamed, or maybe the word is fraudulent. We all feel that people around us overrate us, you know, that we are not quite as smart as people think we are, and we just have to kind of hide, not ask too many questions, and not betray our ignorance, so otherwise people won't find out how much dumber we are than all the people around us. And that tendency, which I find pervasive among smart people everywhere, is one that we really have to fight in a research lab. I suspect in other walks of life you have to also, in order to get people to be willing to be upfront about the mistakes they make. So they're willing to tackle something, even if they're going to be proven wrong.
A lot of scientific discoveries seem to come out of very poorly equipped labs, inexpensive equipment. Major scientific corporations like Hewlett-Packard start in garages. How important is sort of the crude beginnings for some of these discoveries?
I think the crude beginnings are very important because, after all, every idea, however great and complex, I believe, begins between one pair of human ears. And the person who's starting that work almost always begins in a small small single person or small team environment. And when we look at the really important discoveries of the past century, very few of them have been made with the biggest piece of equipment available. It's often the second or third biggest telescope that finds the galaxy rather than the biggest one. An accelerator that got to be used on a more speculative project than the top of the line model, which you have to wait years to get time on. That is something to do with the nature of discovery. Discovery is a private, I think, to a great degree, discovery is a private activity. And as private individuals, an environment which works on a human scale is often the most productive. That's not to say we don't need big machines, we don't need large and complex teams for some things, but the human spark that begins most progress starts usually on a very small scale. And much of what is ultimately discovered is often done in small groups.
You've written and talked about the idea of the invisible college, the idea of colleagues, other physicists, that you can sort of get on the phone and talk over ideas with. And in fact, your ideas about the background noise of the universe fit into somebody else's concept of a cosmology, which eventually led to understanding the Big Bang Theory, all through sort of a series of phone calls. It seems to me that science works best when it's kept open rather than secret and private in laboratories.
I think that's quite true, and I think that one of the things you find all over the world, and I think even in the countries where economies and other discipline tried to be kept in a closed environment, have found that unless one keeps this world scientific openness, unless you pay your membership dues, you're not going to be part of the club. And it's kind of paradoxical, isn't it? I spoke a moment ago of science being based on individuals, loners sitting there getting an idea. But in order to refine those ideas, it takes access to other people. And that's also done on a one-on-one basis very often, but it gets socialized over a much larger group of people because there aren't all that many experts in the world, and science is highly compartmentalized because there's so much to know, and any one person can only keep a small part of it in mind at any one time.
Early on, when you were first studying science in school and going to the Brooklyn Technical School,
Technical High School,
yeah.
Right.
You noticed that there wasn't as much of a cultural bias there in the world of science. And I'm wondering if you still feel that science is a field that's fairly free of cultural bias.
I think there is less cultural bias in science than most other fields. This is why you find so many recent immigrants coming in, especially our Asian immigrants coming in large numbers into science, because you don't have to, as I didn't when I first came to America, you don't have to be able to speak English perfectly. You didn't have to go to the right school and be able to have all the right set of credentials. Much of what your ratings depend on is really in your own control in science, which is very nice. You produce a piece of work, whether it's a program or a new kind of transistor or a new understanding of polymer structure. And the way that science works, that the credit for that belongs to you. It's very different, say, from being an interviewer. You get a job in an advertising, or you get a job somewhere in a personnel department interviewing people. Well, how do you tell who the good or the bad interviewer is? And much of it has to do, I suppose, with social skills, the way the person comes across in things which have little to do with the job itself. In science, you have a little bit more freedom to be a nerd if you want, I suppose, is one way of putting it.
My guest is Nobel Prize-winning physicist Arno Penzias. His book, Ideas and Information, has just been published in paperback. Each new technology that comes along to be a time saver or an advance seems to bring with it its own then problems. Fax machines can send messages back and forth across the country, but now people are getting junk faxes tying up their machines.
Sure. I think what we have to maintain is a general dissatisfaction with technology. I think that's one of the reasons I wrote Ideas and Information. It's not a compendium of look what technology can do for you, but try to give people a basic understanding of what technology does so they can build a strategy around the kinds of things they want and demand more. For example, on a fax machine, which has storage rather than one that dumps the paper out at you, one could look at a cathode ray tube and just scan which of the pages you'd really like printed, and push a button and discard the others the way you do electronic mail. It's not asking for a lot more, and I suspect in a few years some fax manufacturers are going to have that feature, and then junk fax disappears because you can screen it.
What about
you? Sound surprised?
Well, no. Well, it's part of the pleasure of sort of thinking, yeah, well, there can be a technological solution. I've seen fax machines that will store messages without printing them out, but there's no way of seeing them yet. And
yeah,
I suppose
but the thing
there are
is, you store them. Then you just call them up on your screen. Now there's several ways of doing that.
Well, I think that faxes connected with computers can do that.
You want to do. I mean, this is back to the notion of integration. I think one of the great opportunities in our society today is to start to integrate all the junk we have around our house. We have our hi-fi set. You've got a fax. You may have a PC. You've got a microwave oven, a burglar alarm, telephones of various kinds, your answering machine. Well, all those machines playing together could be much more valuable. And for example, when you get your messages on your answering machine, you might like to have them in the form of text. So if there's a text-to-speech recognition system there, which could turn these spoken messages into text, you can then scan them by name on a screen and then pick the ones you want to listen to, and you can junk the rest. It's not that we have too much information. The trick is that the information is in forms we really don't like and forms which we are not comfortable in dealing with. I mean, I don't think I have as much information today as I want. I have a lot of information I don't want, and to be able to sort through the two requires some information tools, and the tools I want are different from the ones other people would want. That's why no single recipe will help everybody.
How have you equipped your own home with new technologies, personal computers, cellular phones, something that maybe hasn't even reached the market?
Let's see. What do I have at home? I don't think there is a single piece of electronic. I recently bought a television set and VCR so we could watch movies at night. But in my own home, the only piece of high technology I have at all is a fax machine. We have a number of telephones. I don't have a. I did have a PC and a terminal for a while, but I just don't use it enough. I find that I do much better with the electronic mail in the office, and occasionally, if I happen to be somewhere else, my secretary will just print the stuff out and fax it to me. But as far as writing is concerned, I wrote ideas and information with a yellow pad and a manually sharpened number 3 pencil. So I don't find I need those things. You know, we have the usual kinds of stuff like a microwave oven and so forth and ordinary automobiles, but no trickery. I do have a telephone in my car. In fact, I have 2 telephones in 2 cars because I don't ever want to be out of touch with other people. But voice contact is usually adequate, so I don't find the need for computers or things of that sort. But I made those choices, and let me just say one more thing here. I made those choices as part of a conscious sequence of acts. That is, I did this based on knowledge. Maybe you need a PhD to be able to have the authority to say, no, I don't really want a personal computer. But it's one of the things I tried to point out in my book is that everybody has the right, in fact, to the obligation themselves to work out a personal information processing strategy that fits them.
My guest is physicist Arno Penzias. In 1978, he won the Nobel Prize for his work with Robert Wilson. His radio astronomy work picked up background hiss, the fossil radio signals from the beginning of the universe that supported the Big Bang theory. He's now vice president of research at the AT&T Bell Labs. His book, Ideas and Information, has just come out in paperback. We'll be back after a short break. This is Fresh Air. I'm speaking with physicist Arno Penzias. I'm interested in the way social decisions are made and butt up against the world of technology. For instance, I think many people are interested in cellular telephone technology, other forms of private communication that go on. But the spectrum of broadcast bands is being taken up in large part by television channels. And I'm wondering if you see a time when society might say, we don't need 13 VHF channels, we could get by with only 10, and we'll turn the rest over to private communication.
Well, I don't, I'd be surprised if you have to attack the... Well, actually, of the 13 channels, you only get 11, because channel 1 is off for something else, right? We all start with 2 to 13, mm-hmm. so there's only a dozen. Well, there are a dozen VHF channels, but there are many times that amount... There's many times that amount of spectrum reserved to UHF, and that's probably a place where... I think our society may really want to go and look to see if that really is the best allocation of resources. As we move into a world where, you know, the wires all over the building, well, you have wires all over buildings, and every time you want to move a desk, you have to go, all sorts of strange people come and get connectors and power supplies and all bits and pieces. I suspect that as we move into the future, be much nicer if you just have a box which you just get power for and everything else is handled by radio waves. That would take a little more spectrum than we're using today.
Mm-hmm. When you go out to the to look at the night sky, do you feel any sort of romance about the stars, or do you examine them as a scientist who sees them in terms of molecules and radiation?
Oh, not at all. I look at them in a very romantic way. I mean, I look up there... and I see Orion, that friendly giant, and I often look up there and say, boy, he was really good to me. If you look at Orion's hunting knife, and the middle star of that is actually a cloud of stars and gas and dust. And some years ago, when I worked on the study of interstellar molecules, we found a large number of molecular substances up in that region, and a lot of gas which hadn't been detectable in any other way before, and so we opened up a whole new field.
My guest is Arno Penzias. His book, Ideas and Information, is a guide to the rapidly changing new information technologies. You pointed out that knowing how to work a computer is not the same as computer literacy, and now that computers are being introduced in schools for people at very young ages, I wonder if you could explain what you see as the difference.
Yeah. Computer, learning how to operate a computer is really rote learning of a set of instructions. If you do A or B, then C will happen. And I think it's far more important to teach children something to do with the rudiments of computation, something to understand how to, and then to adults as well, to understand how to plan computation, how to plan algorithms, how to organize information. The detailed implementation on the machine is the last piece you really need. If you understand how computers work, what they can and can't do for you, somebody else can do the spreadsheet and you can look at it and you're all set.
One of the constant issues that comes up involving new technology is the hardware. It can look very pretty, it can do wonderful things, but often you have the question of what to do with it. I was interested in the beginnings of AT&T when investors were saying, sell the telephones. And somebody came along and said, no, actually what you want to do is sell the idea of connectivity, that what's actually going on is the ability to link people together.
I think what we've seen is a revolution in value. Value used to reside in things. Value today resides far more in intangibles, such as the ability to connect people together, the knowledge groups of people have on how to operate a particular system, the software, if you will, that underlies computing. All those are intangibles. They don't really, they don't really exist in the same way as people had ingots of gold or hogsheads of rum. So we've moved away from the physical into something which is more information based. I don't have a good word for it. And so that's why I talked about it in stories or anecdotes rather than try to philosophize.
Mm-hmm. In the interest of passing information around, what technology are you and your researchers playing with at the labs that looks very exciting that we might not yet know about?
Well, I would think right now the things I'm most excited about today are our work in speech and images. Not that we couldn't recognize some kinds of speech in the past, and not that you can't today buy a computer which can speak to you like this, But we're getting to the point where in a few years, I suspect we will get the recognition of fluent speech. And then coupling that with some of the pattern matching things that we're going to be able to get computers to do, we will have machines which, while they have nothing, they resemble in no way the intelligent machines that people talked about a few years ago when the hype of artificial intelligence was at its height. You'll find these machines will be able to do things which even some of the artificial intelligence people didn't dare predict because it would seem too difficult. And we do it with dumb machines simply because we're able to create algorithms to do to do that kind of work.
It sounds like you must get up each day very excited about going to work.
Oh, yeah. Well, sometimes, the only trouble is sometimes I get up when it isn't even time to get up, and I look at my clock and say, 2 o'clock in the morning, I start thinking about something, and then I say, well, not better, come on, shut up and go to sleep or something. I've got to sleep now. And it's hard because there's so many exciting things. I think the loveliest thing about my job is the number of people who are excited about their work and are willing to explain things to me. So I get to learn about lots of stuff, and there is lots going on. It really is magic. It's kind of a... It's kind of a miracle that I have this job. I have this opportunity to learn about all sorts of technology and share some of that knowledge with others. It's really great.
Well, I want to thank you very much for coming and being a guest with us on Fresh Air today.
Well, glad to do it.
I spoke with Arno Penzias in January. His book, Ideas and Information, is out in paperback. Dr. Penzias won the Nobel Prize for Physics in 1978. He's now Vice President for Research at AT&T Bell Labs. I'm Sedge Thompson, and this is Fresh Air. Next time, a report on the Genome Project, a scientific effort to map the human genetic structure. Wall Street Journal reporter Michael Waldholtz will tell us about the profound implications of the research. I hope you can join us.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and Apple Computer, providing the Fresh Air staff the power to be their best. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Sedge Thompson with Fresh Air. All right, hands up, everyone who owns a VCR. Uh-huh. So I thought a lot of you. Okay, how many of you actually know how to run all the features on your VCR? 2, 3, 4. Okay, I thought so. Today we talk with a man who studies the clumsy, confusing, frustrating ways things are designed and misdesigned in our world, Donald Norman, on the psychology of everyday things. And you'll hear of a rock and roller named Larry Williams. Ed Ward, our rock historian, opens our ears. And Maureen Corrigan examines Salman Rushdie's new essay, Is Nothing Sacred? That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Ann Taylor. Iraq said today that it is ready to hold talks with the U.S., but warned if a conflict comes, the U.S. would be beaten and humiliated. The comments came from the Iraqi foreign minister speaking in Amman, Jordan. NPR's Deborah Amos reports.
Iraqi diplomats have been stressing in recent days that the Westerners held against their will in Iraq are not hostages, but guests. In his address tonight, the Iraqi leader, Saddam Hussein, abandoned the distinction and said the United States was to blame for their detention.
The Americans who are here are the product of a true aggression taking place against the Arab nation and Iraq.
Meanwhile, an Iraqi tanker sailed into a port in Yemen today. It was the first violation of the United Nations sanctions as the crew unloaded the oil. Earlier in the day, Yemen gave assurances that the Iraqi tanker would not be allowed into port. In Dubai, this is Deborah Amos.
The White House has turned down Iraq's latest proposal as it said it was not interested in negotiating with President Saddam Hussein while Iraq is still in Kuwait. When questioned about Iraq's call for talks, Press Secretary Marlon Fitzwater said that many nations of the world are willing to talk with Iraq, but only in the context of compliance with UN resolutions, which call for a complete pullout of Iraqi military forces from Kuwait. A Saudi general today confirmed that Iraq has placed Scud missiles in Kuwait. The Soviet-made missiles are known to be inaccurate, but have the capacity to carry a chemical warhead. NPR's John Edstey reports from Saudi Arabia.
There had been reports several days ago from the respected military publication Jane's that Iraq had moved Scuds to Kuwait. Today, General Turki bin Nasir, a Saudi airbase commander, confirmed that the missiles went in during the first week of the Iraqi invasion. Today, the general said of Iraqi President Saddam Hussein, I think he has the ability and the means of delivering chemical weapons. And he said, you have to expect anything from this guy. But the general said his forces are well trained to counter the threat. The U.S.-Saudi defenses against the Scud include the sophisticated Patriot anti-missile missile. And since the Scud is a liquid-fueled rocket, which must be loaded 24 hours before firing, any fueling activity by the Iraqis might draw a preemptive strike by Saudi or U.S. aircraft. I'm John Idstey reporting from Saudi Arabia.
In Washington, the State Department says that a U.S. citizen in Kuwait has been taken from his home by the Iraqi military, thus increasing the known number of Americans believed to be hostages to 54. Some Westerners have apparently been moved to industrial sites in Iraq. On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrials moved down over 52 points to close at 2,603.96, volume 195 million shares. This is NPR News.
This is Fresh Air. Later, I talk with Don Norman, who analyzes why a company will design and market a tool that mystifies us rather than helps us. But first, some people have all the luck, and all the luck they have is bad. Singer Larry Williams, for example. Rock and roll historian Ed Ward says Williams had the potential to be a star, but bad breaks and a self-destructive streak got in his way.
Met a sweet little girl just the other day. She smiled at me when she passed my way. I said, pretty baby, you sure look fine. I won't rest until you say that you'll be mine. Cause every time I see you fine, fine thing, you make my heart go. Zing, zing. You know that I love
Larry Williams was born in New Orleans, although he moved to Oakland, California at an early age. Like many people who hailed from New Orleans, Larry had music in him, and before he was out of his teens, he was playing with a band in Oakland. He'd visit his birthplace from time to time, and that's how he hooked up with Lloyd Price, who was riding high with Lottie Miss Claudie. When Price got drafted, Williams took his own band from Oakland to L.A. to audition for Price's label, Specialty, but was turned down. But he'd made enough of an impression that when Price came out of the Army and signed with another label, Specialty remembered that Williams had played with him, and when they decided to put out a cover version of Price's next record to compete with their former star, they chose Larry Williams to record it.
Just because you left and said goodbye, do you think that I will sit and cry? Even if my heart should tell me so, darling, I would rather let you go.
It flopped, of course, but Williams took advantage of the recording session to show the Specialty folks that, like their biggest star, Little Richard, he could do New Orleans-style rock and roll, too.
I go, I go, I go, I go on day. Giacomo Filo Andante, Giacomo Filale. Talk about henna, henna. I go on day. Giacomo Filo Andante, Giacomo Filale.
But that was too weird. Specialty wanted mainstream rock and roll, the stuff the kids liked, so he gave them some of that.
Tired of slipping and a sliding with a long tall salad, peeking and a hiding, ducking back in the alley. Don't wanna rip it up, don't wanna dance with Annie. I've got a brand new love, her name is Short Fat Fanny. One day when I was visiting that Heartbreak Hotel, that's where I met Fanny, and she sure looks well. I told her that I loved her, I'd never leave. She put her arms around me, gave me fever. She's my tutti frutti.
Short Fat Fanny was one of the biggest records of the summer of 1957 and one of the biggest sellers of the year, period. Kids liked its list of song titles. Picking out the references was a way of showing off how much rock and roll you knew, after all. And Larry Williams was so sure it was a hit that as soon as the recording session was over, he ran out and bought a Cadillac. It was a used one. If he'd waited until his next record came out, he could have bought a brand new one.
I got a girl named Bonnie Maroney. She's as skinny as a stick of macaroni. Ought to see her rock and roll with her blue jeans on.
Specialty knew what Larry Williams did best, songs with girls' names. So they had him do another.
You make me dizzy, Miss Lizzie, the way you rock and roll. You make me dizzy, 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 when we do the stroll. Come on, Miss Lizzie, let me for a road to roll. Come on, get me, baby.
It flopped. In fact, so did everything else he released from that moment on. A superstar in 1957, Williams was a has-been by 1959, even though he'd recorded songs that would become classics by other performers.
Make love to you. She said, yeah. She said, yeah. She said, yeah, 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 yeah. Oh, come on, daddy. I wanna make love to you, too.
Things were bad, but they got worse. He was busted for narcotics in 1959, and Specialty dumped him. He moved to Chicago, recorded a little for Chess, and then, in 1960, went to jail. When he came out, his friends in Chicago remembered him, most notably Johnny Guitar Watson, a smooth blues man who got him a job producing records for OK, a venerable rhythm and blues label that had just been revived and for whom Little Richard was now recording. Larry and Watson cut an album together, but it didn't do too well, although they got some action off of a version of Mercy, Mercy, Mercy in 1967. He didn't record again for 12 years, and in January 1980, Larry Williams was found dead of a gunshot wound in Los Angeles. Some said suicide, including the cops. Others hinted at murder. Little Richard sang at the funeral, and people wondered how anybody could have such bad luck.
Ed Ward is co-author of Rock of Ages, the Rolling Stone history of rock and roll. He's also a columnist for the Austin Chronicle.
Come on, pretty baby, won't you walk with me? Come on, pretty baby, won't you talk with me? Come on, pretty baby, I'll give you one more chance. Try to save our romance. Slow down.
This is Fresh Air. When something just doesn't work right, we blame it on the design, or more often we blame ourselves for failing to understand how something functions. Donald Norman believes that we're too hard on ourselves. He thinks too many things designed by engineers work well in the lab, but don't function well in actual use. Norman is an industrial psychologist and author of The Psychology of Everyday Things. He teaches in the Department of Cognitive Sciences at University of California, San Diego. I ask him to define good design.
Well, first we better talk about what we mean by good. For example, things that win prizes are not what I'm talking about, because normally they win a prize because they look good, they're aesthetically pleasing. That's not what I mean. What I mean is something that works. You can figure out how the damn thing does its job and you understand it. That's what I mean by good design.
What works for you? What do you consider the ideal melding of form and function?
A pencil.
Because?
Fits the hand, leaves the mark on the paper, is comfortable, portable, easy to carry. Simple things for simple functions. I mean, I really think in general that's the rule, that something can be designed very well to do a task. The difficulty comes when you try to make something do 20 tasks. The VCR is an example because the problem is that it's trying to do so much with so, you know, few controls, or the famous digital watch, which tried to measure lots and lots of things instead of just telling you the time. When you have a simple thing like an egg beater, it works well, because that's all it does. It can be designed for that function. It's when you mix things that you have trouble. You buy them for reasons that have almost nothing to do with whether they actually function well in the home. Then when they come into the home and they don't function well, people tend not to complain. So as a result, the manufacturers never hear these complaints. In fact, when I complain to them, they say, I must be somebody weird because they've never heard any complaints before.
Now, sometimes when you complain, you do so professionally as a consultant. What are you consulting on now?
Well, I do some work in the computer industry, a little bit in the consumer electronics industry. What I like to do is talk to the company in the very beginning about the whole philosophy they should be following, and about the way they should set up testing organizations and the way their engineers and designers ought to work with each other and the general philosophy. So I work at a much higher level, because what I want to do is change the whole approach the company is taking, not just, say, modify one single product, which, you know, only has a short life.
So what are some of the larger organizational issues then? Presumably an organization is set up to function toward one goal, which is to, say, manufacture a product and to sell it and to make a profit. And people would join in that effort.
No. Gee, what a naive view of organizations. I mean, that's what you put in the annual report, right? But no. In an organization, you know, each person, the manager of a group of people, that person's job is to get promoted or to get a reward or to feel good. And so, in fact, if there are difficulties, that person doesn't want to say so. And so you've got a whole bunch of managers, each competing with each other to be noticed by the higher management. So they will be selected for the next promotion or the bigger office.
I had an experience purchasing a cassette player for my car. Walked into the store, found one I liked, and liked where the cassette was, and I could see the tuner and tune it very easily. And it wasn't until it was installed in the car did I realize that when the cassette was not in use, it was slightly popped out of the cassette player, it blocked my view of the radio dial. And I didn't notice this in the store because the devices are displayed at eye level when you're standing up. But in the dash, it was an entire different story. And I'm thinking, presumably, somebody at the car radio tape player manufacturing place would have tried this out and noticed it.
Heavens no. Try it out? In a real car? Come on now.
Sure. Why not?
Because that would be logical and sensible. Look, I was visited the other day by four Japanese engineers from a major Japanese automobile manufacturing company. And they were so proud of themselves, and they brought to me the design of the interior of the car. And they had shown, they had all the competing manufacturers' cars and their own cars, and they were trying to compare the differences, and they wanted my opinions. And they showed me a whole bunch of switches. And they were trying to decide which switch they should put in the dashboard, and they put them out on the table in front of me, and they asked for my opinion. And, you know, I looked at the switches, and I said, this one is obviously of high quality, and this one is pretty cheap and junky, and so I bet you want the high-quality one. And they nodded their heads and smiled. And I said, no, this isn't how you find out. You build a mock-up of an automobile, and you get a family in there. You have a father driving, say. This is a Japanese family, so we'll have the father driving, we'll have the mother beside, we'll have three yelling, screaming kids in the back seat. Then you decide which switch works best. Try it there. Or maybe think about in the snow, and you're wearing gloves, and you're trying to find the switch and push them. And, you know, maybe the cheap switch will be better because it makes a big clunk when it makes contact. Maybe that's good when it's noisy. But they said they couldn't do this because it would be too expensive to build a mock-up. Now, that's crazy. And I opened up the brochures they had showed me, and there was this huge, expensive mock-up of the whole automobile in order to test the shock absorbers. See, they're willing to do that for the mechanical parts because, after all, it requires it for reliability. No one is willing to spend a fraction of that money to test the human parts. Because that seems so obvious.
Much has been made about the way we're now using computers, powerful machines that sometimes help us do our work. And the way we work with them, the interface, is often a cause for discussion, admiration. Some people like the way the Macintosh looks. Some people like the way IBM's look. How important is this interface on the screen to us? Are we, once again, adapting to computer manufacturers' sense of how things should work?
Well, the computer business is interesting because it's maybe the first one that forced upon the public or upon the manufacturers the realization that they had really better worry about the user. That see, in the early days, computers were used by highly technical, skilled people, and nobody cared if the ordinary user couldn't use it. They weren't supposed to. But now that the personal computer has become so popular, it has become very important that things be usable. Now, I think the real problem is that they're computers. See, computers are invisible. They do all their stuff inside. In the old days, we had these mechanical things, and if you got confused, you could always look at it and figure it out. So what I would like to do is get rid of the computer, or at least hide it so you can't see it. So I still want my pencil to look like a pencil, and I don't care if it has a secret computer inside of it. I'd like a typewriter maybe to look like a typewriter. And well, my favorite example was the electric motor. You don't go into your kitchen to use your electric motor, and you don't talk about electric motor interfaces. You may use a blender. You may use a garbage disposal. You may use a coffee grinder. Now, those are almost pure electric motors, but you don't think of it that way. You think of it as a device for doing your task. If we redesign computers that way, they might be usable. We wouldn't even think of them as computers. We just do our task.
You're currently accompanying airline pilots on their flights to study their behavior. What do you hope to learn?
Well, at the University of California, I'm doing research with a contract from NASA, the NA part of NASA, National Aeronautics, looking at aviation safety. And we're looking at the procedures that pilots use in the cockpit. As far as I can tell, almost nobody has really thought about the pilots. Nobody's on the side of the pilots. Everybody crams more and more equipment into that cockpit. So much so that the windows are really tiny. You can barely see out of them. The new electronics, so-called glass cockpits, really aid the pilots in many ways, but also add to their workload in others. And so we've been trying to understand the way these various pieces of equipment go together and say, you know, maybe if you step back and said, what are the tasks that are required of a pilot? Maybe there's some other redesigns that you could do that could help them. See, if you look in a cockpit, you actually see the pilots have tried to tailor it. They carry tape with them. They tape up little notices, or they unscrew the screws and put them back in with a paper clip inside so they can clip up notes to themselves on the side of the cockpit. Some airplanes, you have got to carry a flashlight around so you can shine it on the upper panel so you can read the legends.
That's reassuring.
Yeah, I mean, some of the standard equipment issued to pilots and crew is a flashlight and a roll of tape. Well, that just sounds weird. I mean, it means that people haven't really thought this through in the design stages. There's no place to put your legs or no place to put your coffee cups. You've got to use big, bulky manuals, procedure manuals sometimes, and yet there's no convenient place to spread them out without maybe hitting the instruments or spilling your coffee over everything. You spill a cup of coffee into the radio navigation instruments, it's not a good thing.
Over the past couple of days, say over the weekend, did you go into a store, a hardware store, a pharmacy, find something that you found you liked but then was incredibly poorly designed?
Yeah. Just this weekend, my wife and I went to a hardware store and decided that, you know, we timed to light up our backyard. So we bought a kit of 10 different lights that we could install in the backyard. And it looked like it should be easy to do, very straightforward. And in principle, it was, but we spent the whole weekend and we still haven't finished. Not a single light that I connected worked.
What did you see in, the hardware store that you think works well as ideal melding of form and function?
Actually, many of the tools in hardware stores are really excellent. They're designed by what we like to call folk design, that over the years they sort of evolved. So look at hammers, look at saws, look at screwdrivers. They're really quite well fitted to the task, quite well fitted to the hand. And what happens is that the very first hammer is built and doesn't quite work right, and so somebody modifies it slightly. And over the years and generations, they get to be a pretty perfect hammer. So that was a dramatic contrast between the superiority of folk design, with lots of time to evolve and get out all the problems, and this rapid technological pressure that says, do it better, do it faster, do it cheaper.
Donald Norman, thank you very much for coming and being a guest with us on Fresh Air.
Thank you.
Donald Norman teaches at the University of California, San Diego, and is the author of The Psychology of Everyday Things, which in paperback is called The Design of Everyday Things. Go figure the thinking behind that. This is Fresh Air. Coming up later here on National Public Radio, today's edition of All Things Considered, and one of the hosts, Linda Wertheimer, stopped by. I gather more Mideast news today, Linda.
That's right, Saj. A number of European leaders have extended more support, including more ships, to the crisis in the Gulf and to George Bush. We're also going to take a step back and look at the history of the Gulf and why it has been stable for so long and what stability might be in the future. We'll analyze the position of Israel in all this and look at the possibility that the reserves will be called up and what they might do. We're also going to be talking about state fairs today on All Things Considered, Satch.
A full report later on All Things Considered here on National Public Radio. Summer reading lists often include celebrity autobiographies and thick, weighty family sagas. Critic Maureen Corrigan just read a short but powerful essay by Salman Rushdie, which she recommends.
When Salman Rushdie was invited to give the Herbert Reed Memorial Lecture in England last February, he asked his bodyguards if they thought he could deliver the speech in person. Their response was a panicked chorus of, "What have we done to deserve this?" Rushdie took the hint, and Harold Pinter delivered the lecture for him. It's been reprinted in the latest issue of the literary journal Granta and as a separate pamphlet. The lecture is entitled, "Is Nothing Sacred?" And Rushdie's unexpected answer to this cliched question is, well, sort of. There is something that Rushdie, a non-believer, might call sacred, and that's the novel. He makes a powerful argument here for the novel as the freest and therefore the most necessary form of art. Granted, a lot of people lately have been making statements supporting artistic freedom of expression. But Rushdie's lecture is the most persuasive defense I've read, maybe because he's had to back up his opinions with more than just words. Rushdie didn't choose to be a martyr for art. He had martyrdom thrust upon him. In the interview that accompanies his essay in Granta, Rushdie admits that if he had known what the reaction to satanic verses was going to be, he might have, in his own words, chickened out. In the year and a half since he's been in hiding, Rushdie has done some writing, and he's become a football and TV addict. His favorite shows are 30-something and Dallas. Rushdie has also had plenty of time to think about what got him into this mess, satanic verses in particular, and the subversive power of literature in general. In his essay, Rushdie points out that religion upholds one orthodox language and one set of values above all others. So religion is bound to conflict with fiction, which, he says, has always been about the way in which different languages and values quarrel with each other. Religion tries to give us answers, while literature tells us that answers are easier to come by and less reliable than questions. For Rushdie, the novel is best suited to challenging absolutes because it's the most low-tech of art forms and therefore the one least subject to external controls. The interior space of our imagination can never be closed down. As Rushdie says, the images created there make up a movie that can never be destroyed. What's most moving to me about this essay is its open-mindedness. Rushdie doesn't ridicule the religious belief of his persecutors. He recognizes the desire all of us have to transcend our everydayness. Rushdie's faith in the power of literature both touches and embarrasses me. Like a lot of people, I haven't even read satanic verses. So I wonder what good it is to talk about the liberating potential of novels if we're not reading them. If instead, like Rushdie in his low moments, we're glued to reruns of 30-something and Dallas. But my cynicism comes too easy, and Rushdie has earned his convictions. If anyone knows about the unpredictable power of literature, he does.
Maureen Corrigan teaches at Georgetown University. Salman Rushdie's essay, Nothing is Sacred, is printed as a pamphlet carried by bookstores. Our reviews and commentaries are produced by Naomi Person, with help from Joan Tuohy and Roberta Shorrock. Joyce Lieberman is our technical director. The person who holds our office together is Dorothy Farabee. For Terry Gross, I'm Sedge Thompson.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and from Talbots, retailers of women's classic clothing and accessories through stores and catalogs, 1-800-225-8200. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, reporter Michael Waldholst on the biggest project in medical history, the attempt to map every gene in the human body. Also, we sit down to talk to stand-up comedian Frank Maia. That and more next time on Fresh Air.